Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the Ecocentrics. I'm PK.
And I'm Tom. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the King's Speech. In particular, this line.
This bill will support the future licensing of new oil and gas fields.
Oh, poor Tom. He has his head in his hands.
Oh, dear. I want to start with something before we dig into the King's Speech, which I think was really exciting and positive this week.
Ooh, Tom.
I know, a bit much for me, positivity. So have either of you, and I'm going to extend this to Emma as well, seen Climate Science Breakthrough this week?
No, a Climate Science Breakthrough, as she busily types in Ecosia.
So basically, a load of climate scientists have started working with comedians.
I love it.
And come together to explain climate change in a way that people understand.
Oh, I thought that was the role we were serving, Tom, but I guess not.
I got to tell you what, they're an awful lot funnier than we are.
I'm sure.
But no, really, really good. And definitely recommend a bit of entertainment and comedy around the subject to go and catch up with. So the one that came out this week and is getting loads of publicity is Nish Kumar, who's working with Professor Freddie Otto. And I knew I was a bloody nerd because I've actually known Freddie Otto's work longer than I've known Nish Kumar's work. But basically, Freddie Otto is a climate scientist who works at the University of Oxford. And Nish Kumar, obviously comedian, well-known comedian, everyone knows. And Freddie will explain a climate issue and then Nish will put it into like normal language. And it's so funny because it's just like, oh, we can see the models are showing X, Y, Z. And then Nish Kumar's like, well, actually, what this really means is we're fucked. And the line which I thought was the best in all of it was he said something along the lines of, there was chaos in M&S when we didn't have blue roll. Imagine what it would be like if there's no food. So it was a really good way of just thinking about climate change in a different way. And I just think a nice new genre to bring into this space to actually think about how we can do things a bit differently and maybe communicate with a new audience in a bit of a dynamic way.
Oh, I think that's actually great and brilliant. And I'm disappointed. As with all good ideas, I always think, why didn't Tom and I think of that? But yeah, we can't think of everything.
I think there are multiple reasons why we can't do that as well.
Yes. I think I have an outsized opinion of the potential that we have within us, which is regularly combated against the reality that my husband and son remind me of daily.
Freddie Otto, the climate scientist, is substantially cooler than us. So it's not just the comedy side of it. We're missing a few dynamics.
I've already looked up the YouTube video, so we will have that in the show notes. Thank you, Tom. But comedy aside, there is something that's less funny than somebody else's explanation about what was going to happen with the climate, and that is our esteemed noble king. Isn't that right, Tom?
Yes.
I don't think that's the way I'm supposed to say it. I'm supposed to say His Majesty.
I don't think I've ever heard a Brit ever say our esteemed noble king.
What do I know? I'm just an American.
There's no threat here. We're not going to shoot you just because you've said something bad about the king.
Oh, thank God.
We're no longer in the 1600s.
They're going to pull my application for citizenship. So, it was an historic event. It was the King's Speech. And we haven't had a King's Speech because, 70 plus years, we had a queen.
And it's important to actually frame what the King's Speech is to start with, especially for anyone who's not in the UK, who probably thinks, why the hell does it matter what the King says? Like, they don't really do anything with the politics. The King's Speech isn't a speech about what the King believes should happen. Clearly, we live in a system where we have a democracy and a parliament which makes the decisions. But what the King's Speech is the state opening of parliament. And it's got all these really weird old school quirks, some of which people love, some people hate them. And it was interesting to see Caroline Lucas, the Green Party MP's remarks online about them. But really importantly, the King's Speech is an opportunity for the government to give a speech basically to the King for him to read out, which lays out the priorities of the government for the coming months. At the moment in the UK with our context, is that there is a general election in the next year. This year is one of the last opportunities really to do a big policy push from government and say these are the things we're doing and stamp their mark on the actions that they want to do and really importantly, differentiate themselves from the Labour Party for an election. So that's the context which we're seeing this King's Speech being made. And some really interesting things came out of it.
Oh, yeah. So there were some highlights. And I'm glad you explained some of that because sometimes even though I've lived here for a while, there's still things I go, what? What? So in the King's Speech, he's announced, again, this isn't his policies. This is what the government wishes to enact. So they're introducing legislation to support the future licensing of new oil and gas fields in the North Sea. And more importantly, they say this will strengthen the UK's energy security and reduce reliance on volatile international markets and hostile regimes. But the one that really got me, Tom, was the next statement. It will support the country's transition to net zero 2050. I don't know how this is possible. How do these two things align? Do you?
Because they don't understand the science, quite simply put. There's a fundamental misunderstanding of science. And it's so interesting. Obviously, you have Michael Gove a few years ago saying, well, people have had enough of hearing from experts. Clearly, the government has had enough of hearing from experts as well and understanding these things. And just a complete side here, I'm going to throw in another really positive video for people to go and watch, or at least funny. So Juice Media create things called government ads, but they're basically for part of government policies. And PK, you sounded just like the people that do that. So if you need a second career, I think we know where to turn.
Yes, let me mislead and lie to you in a very convincing and soothing voice.
That's it. And the reason that we want to speak about this week and some of the key issues around this is because actually we know that we can't keep extracting fossil fuels, but people don't necessarily know how much we have to curtail fossil fuel usage or actually where we sit at the moment. So some people may remember in 2021, there was a big report that came out from the International Energy Agency, which I've said before in this podcast, is a relatively conservative with a small C organization about changes. And their landmark 2021 report basically said, we can have no more coal mines, oil or gas fields should be developed. So basically, if we want to keep 1.5 degrees alive as a target for the planet, which we want to, and go back to some of our previous episodes to explore why, we can't be developing new sites. We have more than enough oil, gas, and coal, and fossil fuels generally, in our reserves to be able to do this. And building on this work, a few other papers were done and reports published. And the rough estimate is in the region around about 40% of fossil fuel reserves, which have been developed already, need to stay in the ground for us to limit warming 1.5. Another view as well is that's actually higher than that. And this is one of the more recent papers saying that we need around 60% of extractable oil and gas to stay in the ground and 90% of coal to stay in the ground if we're to keep 1.5 degrees alive. So we already have the resources available to absolutely burn through the 1.5 and 2 degree warming targets. We do not need the licensing of more and the discovery of more fossil fuels.
Yeah, and this is echoed over and over again by the government's own assessment body, the Climate Change Commission, which is an independent body that every year by law has to report and assess what the government is doing and how they're standing up to it. And every year they keep saying we need to, you know, reduce fossil fuel dependency, and we also need to not extract, open up any more coal mines, things like that. So again, this is just, it's something the government knows, might just be something for this election year. I also wonder, do you think, Tom, given the king and his previous talkings or his previous way, I wonder if he was cringing while he was reading this.
I watched the speech live when it was going on, and you could see this pause that he made. And then he just looks up and it almost feels like he rolls his eyes. Like, why am I having to say this? I've spent the last 50 years campaigning for better climate action, and I've got to stand up here or sit here and just spout nonsense. And the thing is, it is nonsense as well. One of the following lines to that fossil fuel section was about energy security. And Claire Coutinho, the government's own net zero minister, even said the following morning that actually extracting more oil and gas will not increase our energy security, because oil and gas gets sold on an international market. It doesn't come straight to us. It gets refined overseas and they get sold on an international market. It's not going to help improve our energy security. So it's actually just crap that what they're saying around this and the reality of how the fossil fuel market works. It's just an exercise to make some more money.
It is all about votes and elections. I'm glad you got to watch it live. I was delivering training. And the number one thing, Tom, that I am always saying in all of my training and all of my delivery, which happens almost every single week, is the number one thing we need to do is stop using our dependence on fossil fuels. And yet here is our own UK government saying, you know, on the very same day I'm delivering that exact same training.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. It is crazy. It's the number one thing in my training.
I see attitudes changing in the programs that I deliver over the last 3 months about positivity around this area. And I think that's the knock-on impact, is that there is so much uncertainty within the business arena. And from a political perspective, within local government and regional governments, actually not knowing what's going on and just seeing this as another culture war that people are fighting over. And I think that's what's really sad about this, is actually I'm just seeing more people losing hope rather than anything going on around this. It's not actually doing much. It's just making people lose hope. And the other side of it as well is it's also making fossil fuel workers believe that their industry is going to keep going. But actually, it can't keep going, and we need to find a transition.
That's true. It's delaying the transition that needs to take place, and it's delaying the training, the opportunity for these individuals to get into a green industry versus the fossil fuel industry.
So one of the things that I say, PK, as well, and I think this is really important, is actually North Sea gas reserves are on a terminal decline right now. Since 2000, extraction has already fallen by about two-thirds. So we've seen a massive, massive drop of oil and gas extraction in the North Sea to today from 2000. And actually, adding these new licenses, although bad, is not really going to make much difference in terms of global carbon impact. And this is really controversial for me to say here, because at the moment, we would see a 97% drop of fossil fuels being extracted from the North Sea by 2050, because A, we're running out of reserves, and B, there's loads of unextractable and economically unviable reserves to extract. With the extra round of licensing, we'll see a 95% drop in the amount of oil and gas being pulled out of the area. So actually, it's only a very marginal change there. And it shows that the climate angle of this is maybe the wrong angle to think about in some ways. It's actually what it does to public discourse around this, which I think is more important, because we need to stop every possible molecule of carbon going to the atmosphere. But really, this is a very marginal amount of extra carbon going in with these new licenses. But what it does for public spirit, I think, is really, really bad.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking this would be quite confusing for people who don't understand the ramifications of increasing fossil fuel production at a time like this. And that many people might be thinking, well, certainly my government wouldn't be doing this if it was going to be that bad for us in the future. And there are some people that do have that kind of, you know, strong faith in their particular party or their particular government. And I think it's just really confusing.
And I think you've made a point in there, and it's really important to pick up on in more detail around this trust in certain actors, state actors in particular, recognizing the risk of climate change. There was a report that came out this summer, which was really fascinating, all about how the financial and economics sectors completely undervalue the risk of climate change because they completely fail to ignore what are called the fat tail risks. So the risk of catastrophic change is not integrated into the models. And there's basically like a 50% chance of the entire GDP collapsing by the middle to late part of this century, which no one considers in the risk modeling because the economists that are in the room aren't telling people that. Whereas when you actually think about climate tipping points, all these other things, the risks are really, really high, but people in power aren't being told that. And there's an amazing book I'm reading at the moment called Five Times Faster by Simon Sharp, which starts to explore that as well. And the fact that actually all of these conservative estimates are going on around the impact of climate change, because no one's really thinking about the impact of climate change beyond the next 5-10 years. So the book starts with an evaluation of actually how the insurance sector, how governments, how coastal communities are starting to evaluate risk. But no one's really thinking about this in a way that's the genuine risk that's there. And this book starts to explore actually how big the genuine risks are.
That's interesting about the financial models. Would you say that insurance companies are farther ahead on this? Their actual financial profit margin is in insuring specific areas. They're really, really on top of it compared to, say, maybe other financial markets?
That's always been the philosophy. So John Elkington wrote a book a few years ago now called Green Swans. And it builds on the philosophy of black swans. So black swans, the idea that there are these massive risks which can come and people aren't aware of them. Green swans are kind of the opposite for green things. So all of a sudden, massive change can happen really quickly. And it was assumed in John Elkington's work that the insurance company would be one of the green swans because they have to value the risk that's coming. But in Simon Sharp's recent work, he's basically saying that insurance companies are thinking about the next year's insurance premiums. And real best case scenario is 25-year risk premiums. They're not thinking around 2070s onwards when these huge catastrophic economic and climate risks are going to manifest themselves. We're obviously going to see catastrophic risks in the short term, but the really catastrophic risk could be later in this century. That's what this book starts to unpack, is that these people that we assume are valuing or understanding risk are not understanding risk in the slightest.
You've given me a lot to think about, Tom, because I'm creating a specific net zero course about finance and risk for finance professionals. And I think you've just given me another resource that I can tap into. So thank you.
One final thing on this as well, because the King's Speech has got a lot of coverage about all of these fossil fuel reserves, and rightly so, because this should not be happening. However, another piece of news came up, which was much, much more catastrophic in a way. And that is actually the plans of the Petrus states. And this isn't to defer blame, because we need to be a leader. And we've historically been a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions. And we need to do more to be leaders. But actually, the Petrus states, including countries where the COP is going to be hosted in a few weeks' time, have completely contradicted their climate pledges and policies with their fossil fuel extracting policies and regimes. And the estimates that came out is that across the Petrus states, the new developments that are going on, is expected to be an increase of 460% more coal above and beyond the 1.5 degree threshold, 83% more gas than beyond the 1.5 degree threshold, and 29% more oil than beyond the 1.5 degree threshold. So actually, enormous fossil fuel reserves are being unlocked right now.
To top on that, what the experts are actually saying about this, and I quote, throw humanity's future into question, insanity.
Positively, though, there are these two sides of this. There's fossil fuel demand and the fossil fuel supply. Yeah. And fossil fuel supply is, they keep pumping it out because they want to make that money. But actually, a lot of the models on fossil fuel demand, so how much we require, is showing that fossil fuel demand is going to peak very soon. And that's because of things like electrification, increased efficiencies, moving over to things like heat pumps. And that's really positive, because actually, all of a sudden, that supply isn't needed. And for financial risks, again, it just shows the massive stranded asset risk there, because all of a sudden this supply which is being created is no longer going to be needed, because the fossil fuel demand is just disappearing.
So in the King's Speech, there was a line about how these new initiatives would help us continue the UK's tradition of being a global leader in decarbonisation. But actually, are we still a leader?
So we are in some senses, but particularly for fossil fuel licensing, I just wanted to throw out some countries which are almost certainly better than us and just recognize that actually maybe we're no longer a leader in this space. In particular, we have our two neighboring states, France and Ireland, who have both banned the exploration of further oil and gas. And in 2020, Denmark cancelled the oil and gas exploration licensing round they were hosting. And I've got a plan to phase out of fossil fuel extraction by 2050 with, even better, a just transition for fossil fuel workers. So these countries are doing really, really good things. And there's also really amazing work going on in other parts of the world as well. There's a load of Pacific Island states which have signed a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, basically saying that we shouldn't do any more fossil fuels and they're going to start transitioning really quickly. So no, we aren't the leader on fossil fuel licensing, fossil fuel extraction. We can just look literally to our neighbours and see people that are doing things better. And maybe if we had some open-minded politicians, we could have that sort of thought and dialogue.
Now, we're going to go into our sustainability superstar of the week. And this particular individual, I have to say, Tom has had the great pleasure of being a personal chauffeur for, Chris Packham. And I also think Tom has his phone number and text messages with him on occasion. Is this correct, Tom?
I feel like that blows it up. Like we have a regular, it's like a Saturday morning chat. I think I've sent him two text messages. The train has arrived. I'm outside of the train. I think this is as far as the conversation that we've had has gone before it.
Did you make a sign up? One of those signs that says his name so he recognizes, oh, this is my ride.
Yeah, and I actually made each letter and a different animal, and I just made animal sounds to him, hoping I could draw him in.
So this week it's Chris Packham.
Why have you chosen him as your sustainability superstar this week, PK?
Because after the King's Speech, he tweeted or X'd or whatever we're calling it now, a clip of what he felt should have been in the King's Speech. Now, again, the King doesn't get to decide what's in this particular King's Speech, but it was a great link, which we'll put in the show notes, of all the comments that the king, when he was allowed to speak more freely, said about climate change over the last few years. And I thought it was really great that Peckham put that out.
I'm going to throw in a spanner for my sustainability superstar.
Well, I don't think Chris is going to let you be his driver next time.
No. And this is controversial, this one.
And
I spend a lot of time ranting and raving about how our government should do more. But I'm gonna actually credit one of the Conservative Party's MPs, who I think has done a very good job this week, and that's Chris Skidmore. So Chris Skidmore wrote an amazing report earlier this year around net zero and what can be done and what needs to be done from a different angle to the angle that we get from us woke environmentalists, as Suella Braverman would call us. But Chris Skidmore basically stood up in Parliament after the King's speech in the debate and said, I will not be supporting this because of the fossil fuel licensing. So he stood up and went against his party and said, no, this is unacceptable. And I think that's particularly brave to break away from what has been accepted within that party. And I think that does need to be applauded as someone that's genuinely trying to do something a bit different.
I think you're absolutely right. Chris Skidmore, Conservative MP, is this week's sustainability superstar.
Sorry, Chris.
But they're both named Chris.
Oh. And that is it for another episode of the Ecocentrics.
And we're going to take just a mini break, but we'll be back on December 5th with a special Christmas episode.
Get your decorations ready, your tinsel out, and prepare to be blasted by sustainability.
Yeah, and if you want to get in touch with us, you can reach out at hello@theecocentrics.
Or find us on all the social media platforms that definitely exist, which I have looked at least once in my life.
Until December 5th. Ciao.
Bye.